Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Rampage school shootings has been a far too common occurrence in our society and our country. And it's not just a modern-day occurrence. It goes throughout our history, with some of the oldest documented events occurring in colonial times. But for us today, the events of April 20th, 1999 awoke a nation when 18-year-old Eric Harris and 17-year-old Dylan Klebold walked into Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado, with guns and explosives, and took the lives of 12 students and a teacher, and wounded 24 others before taking their own lives. Let's face it, if a parent's worst fear would be for your child to be at a school when a horrific event like this takes place, what does one do when you find out your child is the perpetrator? How could this happen? Why did I not know? Why couldn't I see any signs? Well, these are the questions Sue Klebold has been trying to answer every day since. Today, she's a tireless advocate for mental health awareness and suicide prevention and intervention. And over the past 17 years, she has analyzed every detail of her family life in trying to understand the intersection between mental health problems and violence, and why this child she loved took the lives of so many other people. She's written a book about this attempt at understanding, A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. All author profits from the book are going to research foundations focusing on mental health issues, including Mental Health America, American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and the National Alliance on Mental Health, among others. A programming note, today's discussion may be disturbing to some listeners, so listener discretion is advised. Sue Klebold, the mother of Columbine shooter Dylan Klebold, is my guest today. Sue Klebold, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Your book, A Mother's Reckoning, is unflinching. It's moving. It's sad. It's an amazing account of coming to terms with your son's actions. And also the detailed analysis in hindsight of your role as a parent, trying to understand what happened. In writing this book, what was your ultimate goal?
Well, in writing the book, I think my goal changed over time. The important thing was that when I started writing, I wrote because it helped me psychologically. It was a way for me to cope with the sorrow and the humiliation and the intense disturbance that I was feeling. Because when we put something down on paper, it kind of helps us get it off of our shoulders a little bit. So in the beginning, I wrote because I just felt that I needed to talk about it, to tell someone. And because it was such a high-profile incident and there were lawsuits involved, I wasn't able to speak publicly about what I was experiencing. I couldn't go to support groups. So writing was really a tool that I used to maintain my own balance.
Certainly, in part of the book, you journaled from, I assume maybe you kept a journal all your life, but you certainly journaled from within days of the tragedy and trying to process your feelings, and you use this throughout the book.
Yes. Journaling is something that I've always done to sort of help me relax and unwind and look back at the end of a day.
In the book, you recount all the speculation that occurred from April 20th, 1999 on through the next months and year or two on what was happening in the Klebold home. And I have to tell you, the most frightening part of this book is how normal your family seemed right up until April 20th, 1999.
And that is true. And that was something I wanted to say to the world, but wasn't able to say. That I think we have a traditional assumption in this country that when people do bad things, it's because of bad parenting. And I wanted people to see inside a family a little bit. And that's why I included a few pictures in the book. Dylan was like most other kids. You know, he was in Cub Scouts, and he carved pumpkins, and he, you know, went sledding with his friends, and it just is not the background of a child that you would expect to grow up and do such a cruel and horrible thing.
You take pains in the book to describe this, because I think, as you mentioned, the sort of self-denial of any person observing this from a distance is to say, it could not happen to me because I'm a good parent.
Right.
I've never abused my kids. I don't neglect them. And yet what becomes apparent is you were doting parents. You had issues like any other family, getting other family members launched and raising a teenager. And everything seemed as normal as any other family except something went horribly wrong, probably in the year or so prior to April 20th, but certainly manifested on April 20th.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about the self-examination that you've gone through in the years since April 20th, 1999.
It doesn't seem to me to be possible to lose a child by any means without feeling a great deal of guilt, of feelings of things that we could have done differently or should have done differently. And in my case, I not only experienced those things, but I had the whole world telling me that it was my fault. Our governor went on national television to tell the world it was the parents' fault. It was all part of my own processing. I was trying to reconcile in my mind how someone like Dylan, and what I mean is a pretty typical, normal kid, in every way that you could think of, could end up doing something as horrible as he did. That's what I was doing, all this excavating. I went back and I looked at every interaction with him. And it's very natural after, especially a suicide loss, to feel a lot of self-blame for the survivors. And I certainly very reasonably assumed that this had to be something I had done. It seemed reasonable to me at the time. And I would go back to things like, oh, on his third birthday, I got a store-bought cake, but I decorated one for his brother, and maybe that did it. I mean, we really are just searching for an explanation. And it wasn't until I really started to examine Dylan's own suicidality, his writings that I never saw in his lifetime about the pain that he was in, the agony that he was writing about, that I could see that really what was happening with Dylan was a progression where he was becoming more and more disturbed, more and more off balance, and people near him didn't see it. He was working so hard to keep those things from them.
And what becomes evident is Dylan hid this depression that he had, the self-destructive impulses, thoroughly. I mean, you had a life at home in which he might have normal teenager sort of moments of angst, of withdrawal, momentary withdrawal, but he always came back out of it. And for the most part, he was having fairly normal teenager family interactions.
It appeared that way to me, and I've certainly been around other families that have been with their children, and I have felt that their children seemed far more distant and angry than Dylan certainly did, and their children did not end up in a tragic situation. So, you know, it was baffling. It was baffling, and that's one of the things that was so difficult after the tragedy, when all the media reports were coming out and people were just insisting that the parents be talked to because they felt that that will reveal why this happened. And we as parents had no more idea why than anyone else did.
Frankly, it seems what clues were available to you only became evident through exhaustive, and I mean exhaustive, examination in hindsight. You know, your book talks about some of the clues that you couldn't recognize at the time, but only through hindsight that they might have been clues to his true mental self.
Right. One of the clues that we might have had, and I'm putting clues in air quotes because at the time I didn't realize it was a clue, but in his junior year, he went through a bout of trouble. He got arrested for stealing something. He got in trouble at school. He scratched a locker, and he and some friends hacked into the computer system. Now, these were not horrible crimes against others, other than the fact that, of course, stealing would be, but these sort of what I would consider to be more minor offenses at school, these were changes in behavior for Dylan. He had never exhibited anything like that. He'd never been in trouble in his life. If I had known then what I know now, that a change in behavior in an adolescent can be one indication that they are beginning to struggle with mental health issues. There are other things I did not know. Dylan was at times irritable, not all the time, but at times he was. And irritability can be a sign of depression, especially in young boys. There were also things that, if we had known about them, we would have known to be alerted to them. For example, purchasing a gun, which Dylan did. He did that secretly. One gun purchased legally, the other purchased illegally, without our knowledge, without our permission. But his friends, he had a couple of friends who were aware of this, but they had no idea that just by doing that, that was an indication of high risk. And so all these pieces, everybody had little pieces here and there, but nobody was seeing a big picture of what he was experiencing.
And you know, you mentioned the troubles he had his junior year. to your viewpoint, and really this was a part of his sort of hiding these self-destructive impulses, he had sort of what most parents would say straightened up during his senior year. He was doing
exactly what he did and what we thought he did.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we talked to him in those days. I was giving him the parent lecture, you know, you need to straighten up and fly right. And, you know, and then he said, and I said, I don't understand this behavior. We talked about it, and I said, I don't know if this means you should see a counselor. And he said, I don't want to see a counselor. I'm fine. I can handle this. I will prove to you that I am fine and I don't need any help. Those were his words. And by golly, he did. He, you know, had a job. He went to school. He applied to 4 colleges, was accepted at all of them. He did school plays. He was involved with that. He had friends. Our phone rang all the time. Both boys and girls were calling him. He had extracurricular activities. These things helped mask what he was really experiencing.
Through the course of a mother's reckoning, you're going back over that history. You did have a few signs. There's a sign of, and this is one where the school might, if they might have contacted you, might have given you a little more insight. An English paper, I believe, in which was unremittingly dark.
Right. We did get a call from his teacher that, and this was the very last semester. This was a couple weeks before graduation of his senior year. So she called to say, his grades are slipping. Why don't you come in and talk? And we did. And when we got there, we talked. He had apparently made up the work that she was talking about, but she brought up the fact that he had written what she called a dark paper or a disturbing paper. Now, we didn't see the paper. She didn't have it with her. Dylan apparently had it in his possession. We talked about it, and I remember my husband asking her, is this something we should be concerned about? And she said, I don't know. And she had the school psychologist talk to Dylan, and we agreed. She said, if he thinks there's something wrong, we will let you know. The school psychologist talked to Dylan and said, you know, Dylan, you know you're not allowed to write papers with bad language at school. And Dylan said, I know that. And he said, well, don't do it again, okay? And Dylan said, okay.
Oh.
Now, this is not to condemn anyone in the school, not the teachers or the psychologists. It's to illustrate how we were all reading Dylan's affect as a kid who was an okay kid. And there weren't any protocols in place at that time to watch for children at risk. If he had been in a school today that had a protocol for watching for kids at risk, he would most certainly have been flagged. You know, when he had his behavior incidents or when he had written this dark paper, someone would have followed up with him and asked him what was going on. But back in those days, those things really didn't exist yet.
Let me ask you, you've certainly been active in asking school districts and sort of telling your story as a way of getting those programs in place. Are they much better in place today, generally speaking, than they were in 1999?
We still need to do a much better job. There are some that have them. School districts are very uncomfortable with the topic of suicide, and this is still something that we need to work on. I think there is a pervasive and antiquated belief that if we talk about feelings of suicide with kids, we're going to plant the seed and we're going to cause them to feel suicidal. But the research does not support that. The research says that if we give kids a chance to talk about their feelings, to express them and get them out, we are keeping them safe, not endangering them. So I do see changes happening. There are some great programs out there. Some work is being done, but we have a long way to go. And one of the things I think we must do, and that is we must include how to talk to people who are troubled in our all of our training curriculums for teachers. I think every teacher should have a mental health first aid requirement. I think every teacher should have some kind of training in how to talk to their students about feelings of suicidality so that they can save them and get them help and get them past their period of crisis.
My guest today is Sue Klebold. She's the mother of Columbine shooter Dylan Klebold. Her unflinching memoir is titled A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. I should mention that all author profits are going to foundations and research focusing on mental health issues, including groups like Mental Health America, National Alliance on Mental Illness, American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and others. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, after the events of April 20th, your account is sad, seems to be very unflinching in your own behavior, but describing this dual state of guilt and denial that really went on for months, did it not?
Oh, yes. The denial piece is kind of hard for people to understand if they've never been there before. Very interesting. When I hear the news sometime and I hear of some kind of a mass attack or a murder, very often the parents do allow themselves to be interviewed. And what they always start saying is, you know, my child couldn't have done this. It was the fault of someone outside, you know. And I remember being in that place because I did not believe that Dylan was capable of purposely hurting someone or firing a gun at someone. I just didn't believe he could do that. I couldn't envision him doing that. We believed, and so did his close friends, and so did our family members, for the longest time, that he was at this event somehow accidentally, that he had somehow been tricked, that maybe they were planning some kind of theater, some kind of a prank, and someone substituted live ammunition. I never believed that Dylan hurt people intentionally and said the things that they were saying that he said. Not until I got the sheriff's department released their report 6 months after the shootings. And I had gone into it with questions about, could Dylan have been brainwashed and how could he have been tricked? And as soon as they started speaking and showed me pictures of the planning and showed us these tapes that the boys had made, which have come to be called the basement tapes, I was in a state of shock, and really the whole grief process had to sort of start all over again from a different place.
Yeah, there's an excerpt from your journals from October 8, 1999, when you saw the basement tapes and went to the sheriff's office where they laid out the events at the Columbine High School. He said, there's no way a parent could not know that something was wrong. And, I mean, you were sort of going outside of yourself to think of people's reaction. And that was just struck me as so... You're absolutely right. It was the reaction you'd been getting from the public for 6 months, just all being revisited.
The tapes were so blatantly sadistic and premeditated, and I looked at that and I thought, there's no way anyone could believe what I am saying about Dylan, that he didn't act like that at home. If people look at that and assume that that's the way they acted, well, of course I would have seen it or should have seen it. But what I was not able to make clear to people is, this is not the expression, this is not the language, this is not the person that was presented to me. And that was so, I don't think anyone could really understand that. All they could see was him being a horrible bad guy, and they couldn't understand that he didn't act like that and look like that the rest of the time.
You did an exhaustive investigation on rampage shootings and talking with all sorts of psychologists and psychiatrists, and one really stuck with me, which was the supervisor of the investigation, FBI supervisor, who was a clinical psychologist, and he wrote, and you use this in the book, so he believed that Eric Harris went to school to kill people and didn't care if he died, while Dylan wanted to die and didn't care if others died as well.
I believe that is true, and one of the things we know that why that might be true was because Eric and Dylan, although they did this together, were in very, very different places psychologically. Two completely different individuals with different manifestations of whatever was going on. And Eric had a website that I didn't learn about until, of course, the day of the shootings. It was mentioned to me that it existed, and that's another one of those things when we talk about signs. Eric had a website, and a couple of people knew about it, but no one told his parents or us. And so that's just another one of those examples of the signs that were out there that didn't get communicated back to the people closest to them who could have done something about it. But Eric's website was graphically violent, hideously violent, and it's obvious when you look at that. You couldn't look at that website and not know that this was not someone who was just seriously off balance.
Hmm. And eventually you were able to read Dylan's own journals. And a completely different picture. I mean, if there was a different picture that emerged once you saw these basement tapes, another picture yet emerged when you read his journals.
Right. That was part of the recovery process from this. It was kind of like a Rubik's Cube. Every time I would think I would understand what I was dealing with, things would twist and move, and then I would see that I had a completely different situation. When I saw those tapes, I too, like everybody else, was convinced that, well, maybe he just was just a really bad person, and that's it. You know, I raised a monster. But when I saw his writings, and I saw the kinds of things he was saying and talking to himself about, he was longing for a romantic relationship. He talked about his being alone. He talked about, at one point, wanting to get a gun so that he could end his life. He said, I am in agony. He made a reference to him cutting himself. I could see that this was somebody who was really suffering and really over his head in trying to deal with what he was experiencing. And yet, he didn't reach out and ask for help.
And he basically put on a complete front for the people that did care about him.
Yes, and this is one of the things that makes it so challenging to try to help people that we love. I not long ago went to a board meeting for a local suicide prevention organization, and there were about 15 of us in the room, and every one of us had lost a family member to suicide. And about half of us were like me, and we had loved someone who hid their suffering very, very effectively, and when they died, we had no idea what had been going on inside of them. The other half of the room had loved someone who struggled with all kinds of feelings of depression, possibly bipolar disorder. They had been in and out of hospitalization in some cases. They'd had treatment, and yet they had lost those individuals as well. And for me, that clarified what I think we all need to focus on, which is, first of all, for those of us who don't know, we need to do a better job of communicating, educating ourselves about what someone might be going through when we're not aware of it. General population education. The other side of the coin is we must do a much better job of training our healthcare workers who deal with these issues to help them find the most effective evidence-based treatment.
You know, in the immediate aftermath of Columbine, there was, you know, the kids next door, you know, this sort of imagery of, you know, the monsters, as you write actually in the book. Later, there was evidence that came out that the boys had been bullied at some point at Columbine. How much does that play into it, in your mind, their actions?
I think the bullying is a huge factor. I think it's cemented their bond to each other. I believe they experienced at least one, if not more, humiliating incidents that bound them to each other and also gave them both a sense of purpose in their shared rage. One thing that we tend to do, however, that we must avoid doing, and that is we oversimplify when there is either a shooting or a suicide and bullying is involved. Bullying plays a huge part, but we cannot say that bullying causes suicide. It is not a causal factor. If that were the case, there'd be millions of shootings. I mean, people are bullied every day. But what bullying does, it's a risk factor. It increases one's risk of dying by suicide or, in some cases, of taking part in shootings of other people. And bullying is a very serious problem for teens, and we need to do a much better job of helping them understand it and handle it and take part in certainly a kinder, gentler society.
You also, in the book, offer guidelines for reporting on rampage shootings. The media coverage, certainly you were in the white-hot spotlight. You chose not to address the media or really the public in the months afterwards, but you do offer guidelines for reporting on it. What are some of the things the media needs to change in their coverage of this? Unfortunately, it's all too often a situation.
There are some excellent guidelines out, and I am not prepared for this question to actually list them all, but some of the guidelines are around how the media can report on suicides to reduce contagion. And one example of what we inadvertently do to increase risk of suicide is we look at everyday incidents like someone breaking up with a girlfriend or being bullied at school or being arrested. And we make statements like the suicide occurred because of that. And what that does, it kind of teaches or conditions us that those are conditions under which suicide is a logical choice. And that is not the case. And we have to be very careful of doing that. I mean, certainly in movies for years, you know, some actor will have a breakup or a disgrace and they go off in the ocean and we never see them again. But that is oversimplifying suicide. Suicide really is about mental health, and it's not about something that happens to us on the outside, although those do increase our risk and in many cases our misery and our suffering.
Unfortunately, we all crave simple answers to difficult questions, and they're very, very seldomly ever simple. My guest today is Sue Klebold, the mother of Columbine shooter Dylan Klebold. Her book is titled A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. Now, you have had some contact with families of the victims. You write in the book that you wrote letters to every family. I'm not sure they were ever delivered, but you actually learned about every one of Dylan's victims and wrote them letters. And you have had some reach out to some families. What has that process been like?
The actual writing of the letters was one of the most difficult things I ever did. In order to write the letters, I wanted to get to know the individual that they lost or that experienced injury. So I had to do something that I'd been avoiding, which was read the paper and read about people and get to know as much as I could who they were. And it was heartbreaking to not think of these families, of the people who were hurt, as just numbers. They were really, really people, and to read about them and know them and to know what that individual had been like was horribly difficult. It took me weeks to write the letters, and I did a lot of weeping, and it just was hard. But I really felt somehow that I had to try to make a connection. And one of the things I think I was trying to do was to say, look, I'm sorry for what my son did. And second of all, I'm not my son. That, this was a terrible thing that happened. I'm so sorry for what happened to you. And in my deepest hope was that at some point it might be beneficial for them and for me to meet each other or to speak with each other. And I wanted to leave that door open so that, in some way, if it was meant to be, if it was possible, we might have an opportunity to be able to reach out and access each other.
Well, and in fact, you have had some relationships with some of the family's victims. And I'm really struck by a comment from one person who wrote you, a member, who said, just like everyone else in the world, they were looking for a simple answer. And the whole thing about any incident like this, and unfortunately there are way too many, there just aren't simple answers, are there?
No, and I think that's one of our downfalls as a society, as we try to make very complicated things simple. And we try to, and I think that is something that contributes very much to misunderstanding and fear and hatred. And things are complex, and accepting and understanding their complexity gives us a lot more opportunities to try to prevent things like this.
All right. Well, Sue Klebold, we appreciate your time today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sue Klebold, the mother of Columbine shooter Dylan Klebold, speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her book is titled A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. And all author proceeds and profits from the book are going to foundations and research institutions focusing on mental health issues. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.